Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, January 6th. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. I'm looking forward to reading with you today. We will start, as we usually do, with the weather here. Today, I woke up, I don't know about you, but when I went outside for a moment, there was snow around, just a little dusting. But generally today, it's going to be mostly cloudy, a wind from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles an hour, with a high of 37 and a low of 27. Tomorrow, kind of the same, mostly cloudy, winds from the west, 5 to 15 miles an hour, high will be 34 and the low 23. And then on Monday, we start to see the weather beginning to change. The high will be 37 and the low 29. Winds are going to be from the southeast, 15 to 25 miles an hour. And there is a chance of rain and snow from what I've seen in other sources. It looks like that will come later in the afternoon and into the overnight hours on Monday. And then Tuesday is when we're looking at some accumulation of snow with a windy day, northwest 20 to 30 miles an hour, high of 33 and a low of 20. If you're curious, the normal high around this time of year is 28 with a low of 12, but in 1961, there was a record high of 53 degrees, and get ready, in 1910, there was a record low of minus 21. Sunset tonight will be at 4:51. It is getting a little longer each day, and then sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:35. Our weather story today is from Eric Dean, who takes us on a little trip to the past. He says, "Let's bring up a topic that my 11-year-old son and I were discussing. We were talking about how we receive information now versus when I was his age. It wasn't too long ago. I am a 90s kid. My son Mason said that he gets snow day information from a notification on his tablet, and I get it on my phone. I mentioned that we didn't have that growing up. He said, 'I know, you all sat in front of the TV watching the school closings ticker like it was the NBA draft.' Well, he isn't wrong. I can hear my grandmother now telling me to move away from the old school floor model TV because she can't see it. Anyone else remember that?" And Eric concludes with, "Have a wonderful weekend." And all of us here at IRIS certainly agree with that. On the Gazette's front page, the lead story is an in-depth article by Marissa Payne titled, "Panel Tables Cedar Rapids Schools Request to Rezone Harrison." A contentious plan to demolish Harrison Elementary School and build a new facility on the site will be paused for more community feedback, the Cedar Rapids Community School District's operations official said Thursday, as a city panel sent the district back to firm up its plan. Cedar Rapids City Planning Commission, in a unanimous vote of the six members present, tabled the district's request to rezone the 5.8-acre site at 1310 11th Street Northwest from traditional residential single unit to public institutional district to allow for construction of a new school after demolition of the existing structure. This request was submitted November 2nd, before the school district's $220 million bond referendum was defeated by voters. The bond would have funded a new middle school at an undisclosed location and other facilities improvements across the district. The Harrison closure was not part of the bond issue, but was a point of contention among many voters in the district's push for support. To improve operational efficiencies, the district facilities master plan calls for transitioning to larger elementary schools in neighborhood locations. The new school would serve the combined areas that currently serve students attending Harrison and Madison Elementary on Woodside Drive Northwest. Chad Schumacher, the school district's operations director, said the district is reviewing proposals from firms that would help assess the facility's plan, understand why voters opposed it, and receive input from Harrison and Madison Elementary families on how to move forward with the Harrison building. He said the district will not put plans out to bid until there's a clear vision with the neighborhood. Schumacher said, quote, "We heard loud and clear through a 60 no to a 40 yes vote on our last bond issue. We are dedicated to revitalizing the community with new schools or renovated schools in this city," end quote. After City Zoning Administrator Seth Gunnerson said he wasn't informed of the district's plan to pause the project, commission members moved to table their recommendation until the district lands on a plan. Before sending the rezoning request to the Cedar Rapids City Council for consideration, Gunnarsson said it needs to be clear to the elected officials what they're voting on and how the neighborhood would be engaged in the decision. Commission member Fred Timko said the panel considers rezonings by looking at factors such as parking, stormwater retention, the site plan, and fit with the neighborhood. Before proceeding with demolition, Timko, who has redeveloped historic properties, said he would like the district to seriously look at reusing the building and convince people that it's not worth saving. Timko said, "We've got this preliminary plan in front of us that may or may not survive. If they're going to pause and take a sincere look at an alternative, I think we should wait and see what they really want to propose." Some members of the commission and community providing public comment were confused as to whether the district was truly pausing the plan while still bringing the request forward to the commission. But district officials said they wanted to seek permission now to ensure a school can be built there. Superintendent Tawana Grover told the Gazette the primary objective of approaching the commission was to make sure we can rezone the Harrison site so a school can exist there. That is going to be critical if we want to have a school in the Northwest neighborhood. Historic preservation advocates, led by local nonprofit Save CR Heritage, have adamantly opposed demolition of the school, which was opened in 1930 to replace an earlier Harrison Elementary that was destroyed in a fire the year before. The structure has English Tudor-style features and exterior detailing and may be eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places. City Historic Preservation Code states that any demolition permit has to be reviewed by the Historic Preservation Commission, which may put a 60-day hold on the demolition to document the building, buy time to seek alternatives, and conserve historic details. The applicant could appeal a 60-day hold on demolition to the council. If the commission decided not to put a hold on it, that likely also could be appealed. Gunnarsson said, "There's no path for the city to deny a demolition permit, a process handled by the Building Services Department." District officials have maintained construction and maintenance of a new school would be more cost-effective than renovating the existing property and building an expansion. They said they would preserve a 22-foot mural painted in 1935 and incorporate existing architectural elements such as windows, signage and coins, exterior detailing, into the new structure. The new school and other elementary school improvements would be funded through Secure and Advanced Vision for Education, also known as SAVE, an existing statewide school infrastructure sales and services tax. Grover said the board's previous decision to build a new school on the Harrison site came from conversations with families in the area and a survey indicating a true need for that community to have a school there, a new one in that location. Enlisting a firm to review facilities, including Harrison and Madison, will help the school board get more feedback in the facility planning process, Grover said. Community members, including city officials, can be involved in the discussions to understand both the district's and city's needs and projected growth. Grover said, quote, "Once you take a wrecking ball to it, you can't get it back. It's better for us to have that feedback as we continue to make decisions about our facilities," end quote. Once there's enough data to determine a course of action, Schumacher said the district will release plans for the school board approval, then hire a contractor. If construction started in July, he said work would likely finish by December 2025. This timeline is tentative while other alternatives are considered. The Gazette has also included on its front page an article from the Associated Press about the Perry school shooting. It is under the title, "Principal Risked Himself to Protect Students." An Iowa principal critically injured in a school shooting put himself in harm's way as he tried to protect students from a teenage shooter armed with a shotgun and a handgun, state authorities said Friday. Perry High School principal Dan Marburger and six other staffers and students were injured in the Thursday morning shooting that left one sixth grader dead. The 17-year-old student who opened fire also died of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot. The State Department of Public Safety said Marburger, who was being treated in a Des Moines hospital, acted selflessly and placed himself in harm's way in an apparent effort to protect his students. A day after the shooting, the small community of Perry was somber. Yellow crime tape still lined the campus that Perry High School shares with the town's middle school. Flowers and stuffed toys had cropped up in many memorials, and classes across the district were canceled Friday in favor of counseling. Perry Superintendent Clark Wicks said the soonest classes will resume in the town will be next Friday, saying, "This is an extremely painful and difficult time for our entire school community, and in our grief, we will take time to remember." The shooting happened just after 7:30 a.m. Thursday when the student opened fire, forcing people to hunker down in classrooms and offices shortly before classes were set to begin on the first day back from winter break. The student killed was identified as 11-year-old Amir Joliffe. An autopsy showed he had been shot 3 times. The news that 7 students and staff suffered wounds or injuries of varying degree during the shooting was 2 more than authorities said Thursday afternoon at a news conference. It wasn't immediately clear if all 7 were shot, and spokespersons did not immediately respond to inquiries seeking clarity. Besides Marburger, 2 students remained hospitalized. In a Facebook post Thursday night, the principal's daughter said he was in surgery all day and is currently stable. Claire Marburger called her father a, quote, gentle giant, who would want more attention on the other victims and their families and less on himself. She said it wasn't surprising that her father tried to protect his students, saying, "As I heard of a gunman, I instantly had a feeling my dad would be a victim, as he would put himself in harm's way for the benefit of the kids and his staff. That's just Dad." Wicks called Marburger a hero whose actions saved lives, and he expressed appreciation for how several other staff members responded as well. Authorities said the suspect, identified as Dylan Butler, had a pump-action shotgun and a small-caliber handgun. Mitch Mordved, the State Investigation Division's assistant director, said during a news conference that authorities also found a, quote, pretty rudimentary, improvised explosive device and rendered it safe. A law enforcement official briefed on the investigation said federal and state investigators were interviewing Butler's friends and analyzing his social media profiles, including posts on TikTok and Reddit. However, authorities have provided no information about a possible motive in the shooting. Shortly before Thursday's shooting, Butler posted a photo on TikTok inside the bathroom of Perry High School, the official said. The photo was captioned, quote, "Now We Wait," end quote, and the song "Stray Bullet" by the German band KMFDM accompanied it. Investigators have also found other photos Butler posted, posing with firearms, according to the official, who was not authorized to publicly discuss details of the investigation and spoke to AP on condition of anonymity. 2 friends and their mother, who spoke with the Associated Press, said Butler was a quiet person who had been bullied relentlessly since elementary school. Sisters Yesenia Roeder and Kamya Hall, both 17, said alongside their mother Alita that it escalated recently when his younger sister started getting picked on too. Yesenia Roeder Hall said he was hurting. He got tired. He got tired of the bullying. He got tired of the harassment. Was it a smart idea to shoot up the school? No, God, no. Rachel Karras, an 18-year-old senior who fled jazz band rehearsal when she heard gunshots Thursday morning, said she believes Marburger would have addressed any bullying that was reported to him, saying, "Any instances that happened toward Dylan were resolved because my principal is an amazing man who was on top of it all." She said she and her family knew Marburger well. Her older sisters grew up with his daughters, and his wife was one of Karras' teachers when she was younger. Police said Thursday they believe Butler acted alone, but investigators have not said how Butler obtained the firearms used in the attack. Wicks wouldn't discuss whether Butler had been bullied, but he defended the way his district responds in those situations, saying, "We care about every kid. We take every bullying situation seriously, and our goal is always to have that safe and inviting atmosphere. But I'm not going to comment on this individual case as well as any other individual case," end quote. Butler's parents have been fixtures of the Perry community. His father is director of the city's airport after serving as its public works director for years, where he won praise helping clean up Perry after a devastating windstorm in 2020. His mother also has owned a small business and served on a city development board. The parents have not responded to messages seeking comment. On Thursday night, hundreds of people gathered for a candlelight prayer vigil at a park where hours earlier, students had been brought to reunite with their families after the shooting. Bundled up against freezing temperatures, they listened to clergy from many faiths and heard a message of hope in both English and Spanish. Classes were closed Friday at St. Patrick's Catholic School, where Dylan had been a student when he was younger. The school made grief counselors available and planned a rosary for Friday night. "Our thoughts and prayers are being offered for those affected today at the high school building," they said in a Facebook post. Despite the shock of the shooting, Perry Mayor Dirk Cavanaugh expressed confidence the community would get through the painful experience. "We are a small town, but we will pull together in a big way to get through this." The story is accompanied by two photos, one a school official carrying bags. She's wearing a jacket and with her head down, and she is making her way back to her car after leaving the middle and high school building Friday in Perry. And then there's also a photo of a ground sign stuck in the ground, hand-painted. It says, "Perry Strong," and the caption says, "A sign along Highway 141 in Granger shows support Friday for the neighboring community of Perry." There are balloons around the sign. The final story on the Gazette's front page is from Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, and it is titled, "Iowa Reviews If Foreign Investors Tied to Farmland Bought for Solar." The Iowa Attorney General's office is reviewing whether the purchase of more than 75 acres of Linn County farmland, slated to be part of a large solar project near Coggin, violates state law prohibiting foreign ownership of agricultural land. Foreign farmland ownership, especially by China, has been a concern nationwide, and the Linn County review comes as several Iowa lawmakers have said they'd like to see changes that make farmland sales more transparent. J.D. Shulton, Democrat of Sioux City, said in November, "We should know who our neighbor is. The way the system is now, whether intentional or not, it's really hard to find out who bought the land down the road. Is it a Wall Street firm, or is it Uncle Bob down the road, or was it Bill Gates?" End quote. The Linn County Board of Supervisors in January 2022 approved rezoning to allow a 640-acre solar farm west of Coggin. Clenera, an Idaho-based company, would develop the utility-scale project and then sell the electricity to the Central Iowa Power Cooperative, known as CIPCO. Neighbors Marty Robinson, Paula Robinson, Tom Robinson, and Laura Robinson opposed the project and filed a lawsuit that still is winding its way through appeals after the 6th Judicial District dismissed the suit in February. Clenera has leased most of the land for the project with plans to remove the panels after 35 years, but the company, through Coggin Asset Company, LLC, purchased two agricultural parcels totaling 76 acres for $1.45 million in May from Joel and Carrie Payton. The company also bought two small residential parcels adjoining the ag land for $280,000 from other Payton family members, Linn County Assessor records show. Charlie Nichols, Planning and Development Director for Linn County, said, "I do think this is in the footprint of the Clenera project. There are panels planned to be on that parcel," end quote. It's unclear why the company purchased rather than leased this land. Joel Payton declined to comment on that, but said he and his wife also have leased some land for the project. While Clenera's offices are in Boise, the company was purchased in 2021 by Enlight Renewable Energy Ltd., based in Tel Aviv, Israel. Founded in 2008, the website says Enlight develops, designs, constructs, finances, owns, and operates power plants that generate clean energy across U.S., Europe, and Israel. Enlight's website says its largest investors are in Israel, which is where Iowa's law prohibiting foreign ownership of agricultural land may kick in. Iowa's primary foreign land ownership law, Chapter 9I.3, says a, quote, "non-resident alien, foreign business or foreign government shall not purchase or otherwise acquire agricultural land in this state," end quote. Foreign people or firms who owned Iowa farmland before January 1, 1980, were allowed to keep it but were prohibited from buying more. There are some exceptions to Iowa's law, including farmland used for, quote, testing, developing, or producing seeds or plants for sale or resale to farmers, end quote, and land used for research or experimentation, not profits. Iowa has nearly 514,000 acres of foreign-owned or leased land, according to the most recent data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Linn County has 1,783 acres of foreign-owned farmland, with most of it purchased before 1980, and more than half owned by one German family, a Gazette investigation showed. Through the Agricultural Foreign Investment Disclosure Act, foreign people and firms must report to the U.S. Department of Agriculture farmland ownership or leases of at least 10 acres or land that produces at least $1,000 in gross receipts a year. This includes multinational firms with major ownership in other countries. The Robinsons asked the Iowa Attorney General's office last fall to look at Clenera's purchase of the farmland to see if it violates Chapter 9I. The family heard back December 21st. Assistant Attorney General Jacob Larson wrote, "Thank you for your September 13, 2023 email and the information you provided to our office concerning the purchase of farmland and the potential Iowa code violations. Our office is reviewing the information and takes these violations seriously," end quote. Larson went on to say he could not comment on pending investigations or enforcement actions. Clenera provided a statement Friday. Quote, "The Coggin Solar Project, currently in development, will power an estimated 20,000 Iowa homes with low-cost, clean, renewable energy for several decades. We are excited to do business and be a neighbor in the Linn County community. Although Clenera LLC is participating in the development of the project, the land parcels in question are fully owned by Coggin Asset Company LLC, which is U.S.-owned and controlled," end quote. Spokesman Jake Melder did not immediately respond to a question asking him to clarify how Coggin Asset Company was separate from Clenera. The warranty deed for the sale states it should be sent to Coggin Asset Company in care of Clenera LLC in Boise. The Iowa Secretary of State's office does not have a listing for Coggin Asset Company LLC, but does have a business registered as Coggin Solar LLC with the same Boise address as Clenera that describes itself as a foreign limited liability company, end quote. Nichols said a change in who owns the land near Coggin doesn't affect the zoning change that allowed a solar development. The Iowa Utilities Board issued Clenera a certificate of public convenience, use, and necessity on November 9, 2022. That permission is not related to land ownership. On the Iowa Today page, I alluded to this earlier a little bit, but there is this article from Brittany Miller that says first winter storm of 2024 is en route. The first winter storm of the year will blow across the Midwest early next week, meteorologists are forecasting. The storm system could charge through southeastern Iowa on Monday afternoon into Tuesday evening. It brings a 40% to 70% chance of at least minor winter travel impacts to eastern Iowa, with the potential for accumulating snowfall and strong winds. As of Friday morning, the storm's exact track and its expected snowfall or rainfall contributions were uncertain. I'm going to just add this sort of as an update of my own, that what I am hearing is that there is a chance that we are going to get a fairly substantial amount of snow in the area. I'm just saying that so that you can prepare accordingly. Moving back to the story, be sure to check weather forecasts and road conditions before you travel anywhere and pack an emergency supply kit for your vehicle. Next, we have in Iowa Today this article from Emily Anderson, "Deal to House Federal Inmates in Linn Unresolved." Dateline Cedar Rapids. The U.S. Marshals Service said it has made its, quote, final offer, end quote, to pay the Linn County Jail $100 a day to house federal inmates there, a 16% increase, but not the 48% increase Sheriff Brian Gardner had asked for. The Marshals Service for the Northern District of Iowa, responding to an article Friday in the Gazette about the agreement, said the rate it has offered is the highest in the district, but it would comply with the sheriff's desire to end the agreement Senate later this month if he wants. Christopher Barther, the U.S. Marshal for the Northern District of Iowa, wrote to the Linn County Board of Supervisors saying the USMS would like to house prisoners at the Linn County Correctional Center, but will follow the request of the sheriff to remove them by January 20, 2024. The two sides have long been attempting to renegotiate the deal for housing federal inmates at the county jail, which Gardner said has faced significant cost increases since the original agreement. The deal has substantial implications for the county. Both the existing agreement and the proposed and rejected new proposal allowed for the jail to house up to 125 federal inmates per day. If the Linn County Jail had housed all 125 federal inmates daily under the current $86 per diem agreement, it would have been paid $3.92 million in 1 year. Under the $100 proposed agreement, the county could be paid up to $4.56 million per year. Gardner told the Gazette the two agencies have been in negotiations over the intergovernmental agreement since December 2022. Because of the lack of agreement, the sheriff on December 21st sent the Marshal Service a notice of intent to terminate the deal, giving the service until January 20th to either reach a new deal or remove all federal inmates from the Linn County Jail. A statement Friday from Nicholas Bonifazi, the supervisory deputy of the U.S. Marshals Service for the Northern District of Iowa, said the intergovernmental agreement can be terminated by either party at any time with a 30-day notice. The agreement does not have an expiration date, but does specify that the per diem rate for inmates and the transportation hourly rate, the amount spent paid to the jail per hour spent by jail staff transporting and guarding federal inmates outside the jail, may be renegotiated after 48 months. The 48-month period ended in October, meaning the per diem rate of $86 and transportation hourly rate of $43 could be renegotiated. But the sheriff's office requested an earlier renegotiation in December 2022 because of significant cost increases, according to Gardner. The Marshal Service agreed to do the early review. It made an offer to the sheriff's office in September of the $100 per diem rate and a $45 transportation hourly rate, which the sheriff did not accept, according to Bonifazi. The sheriff's office had requested a $127 rate when it asked to review the agreement in 2022. In fiscal 2023, the Marshal Service paid the county $2.49 million to house inmates. Gardner said there were more than 100 federal inmates in the jail during most of the fiscal year, but recently there have been fewer than 30. The Marshal Service contested this number, stating there have been fewer than 100 federal prisoners at the jail for over a year, and nearly every reduction was made at the jail's request. In his email to the supervisor, Barther wrote that the service has been removing prisoners recently only because of the sheriff's letter of intent to terminate the agreement. Gardner said Friday the number of federal inmates has decreased over the past few years for several reasons, including the pandemic. Several months ago, one of the cell blocks in the jail, which housed mostly federal inmates, closed down for a few weeks because of plumbing issues. Many federal inmates were removed, and the numbers haven't rebounded, Gardner said. Finally, he said, "We're certainly not bringing in the revenue we ever brought in before, and it's my impression and understanding that those numbers were not going to regenerate back to where they used to be." We're moving to the Insight page now, where we have the Gazette's editorial, which is under the broad heading, Budget Should Invest in Priorities. The Gazette says, all we know for certain is that the Iowa legislature will reconvene for the 2024 session on Monday morning. As for what they'll do after that, we only have hints. Judging by a series of legislative preview articles written by Gazette and Lee Enterprises State House reporters, top Republican leaders who run the House and Senate are keeping their plans close to the vest. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds isn't talking at all, having refused to be interviewed for the series. Reynolds will give her condition of the state speech on Tuesday evening, which may reveal more details on what the Republican agenda will look like. At least we hope so. Republican leaders asked about addressing a shortage of hundreds of thousands of child care slots and the loss of providers talked mostly about what lawmakers passed last year. No new plans have been offered. After approving multiple bills attacking the rights of LGBTQ Iowans, in particular transgender and non-binary kids, leaders say they have no plan to return to those topics in 2024. But some Republicans want to pursue a Religious Freedom Restoration Act that would allow discriminatory actions against LGBTQ Iowans and other groups based on religious beliefs. It's an unneeded bill that will spark yet another culture war battle. And, of course, Republicans are talking about accelerating tax cuts passed previously and potentially passing new tax cuts. Reynolds has said she wants to eliminate the state income tax by the time her term ends in 2026. Tax cuts are slowly crippling the state's ability to provide needed funding for children's mental health, state universities, public schools, health and human services, among other items that should be state priorities. Iowa's water remains dirty. Our state parks need investments. Our nursing homes are being left without timely inspections, endangering residents. Instead, the Republican top priority has been passing billions of dollars worth of tax cuts. To keep the cuts from blowing up the budget, the majority has underfunded needs, so billions in, quote, surplus dollars can be socked away. The Republican-created Taxpayer Relief Fund contains $3.7 billion. It's been a wealth shift, with most of the tax cut benefits going to wealthy earners, while underfunded schools, university tuition increases, and diminished services hurt middle- and low-income Iowans. Lawmakers have shifted the funding burden to local governments, where property tax increases exceed income tax cuts. Republicans argue tax cuts make Iowa more attractive to newcomers. But the true cost of these cuts, tainted natural resources, poorly funded public education, and inadequate basic services, also makes Iowa less attractive to young professionals. Add in open hostility toward LGBTQ Iowans and limits on teaching authentic history, and Iowa doesn't live up to its new slogan, "Freedom to Flourish." Republicans should refrain from further tax cuts and use our socked-away surplus to make needed investments improving the lives of all Iowans. As a reminder, you are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, January 6th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. We'll look first at the shorter notices from Marion Jimmy Leroy Gusta. It might be Husta, I don't know, G-U-S-T-A, age 81 of Marion, died Thursday, January 4th. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is handling those arrangements. From Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, Janet E. Kramer, age 71, died Friday, December 15th. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home is assisting the family. In Waukon, Tim Gress, age 52, died Wednesday, January 3rd. Those arrangements are being held are made through Martin Grau Funeral Home. And Williamsburg, Richard A. Cruz, K-R-U-S-E, age 79, died Thursday, January 4th. Those arrangements are being made through Kloster Funeral Home in Marengo. And the final short notice from Sigourney is Jared Dyson, age 57, who died Friday, December 5th. Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Sigourney is assisting the family. As we move to the longer notices, first we have Jake Valentine of Iowa Falls, who was 90 years old and died on Tuesday, January 2nd at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center. There will be a visitation from 9:30 a.m. until the service time of 11 a.m. today, so that will have been conducted by the time this is broadcast. The arrangements were made through Woodley Funeral Home, and they tell a story of Mr. Valentine, who was apparently a long-time funeral director. He had a degree from the Institute of Mortuary Science and had had an apprenticeship locally, and then he purchased the Hoover Funeral Home in Marengo, where he served there from 1964 to 94, and he also assisted at Lynn's Funeral Home in Iowa Falls as a semi-retired assistant for a long time. Next, we have Claire Gingrich, age 99 of Kelowna and formerly of Iowa City, who died on Wednesday, January 3rd at the Pleasant View Home in Kelowna, just a few weeks shy of her 100th birthday. A celebration of life will be held Monday, January 8th at 11:30 a.m. at the First Mennonite Church in Iowa City, and then burial will be held prior to the service at 10 a.m. at the South Gingrich Cemetery in Kelowna. There will be a visitation tomorrow, Sunday, January 7th, from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Petersheim Funeral Home in Kelowna. If you are interested, a memorial fund has been established for the Crowded Closet, the University of Iowa Stead Children's Hospital, and First Mennonite Church. We also have an obituary for Dr. Holmes Alfred Semkin, Jr. of Iowa City, who passed away on January 2nd. He was 88 years old, and he was a longtime employee of the University of Iowa in the Department of Geology. He dedicated his life to teaching and research and was married to Elaine Friedrichs, his University of Texas sweetheart and wife of over 60 years. There will be a private family graveside service at Oakland Cemetery, but there will be a visitation for family and friends on Thursday, January 11th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service. There is a more complete obituary at the Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service website, and the family asks that in lieu of flowers, memorial donations be made in his memory to either the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History or the American Battlefield Trust based out of Washington, D.C. Our final local obituary is for Ronald C. Bark, B-A-R-K, age 93, of Solon, who passed away December 30th at the Solon Nursing Care Center. A graveside committal service will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, January 10th at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Solon is serving the family. He was a longtime accountant at the company that's now known as Alliant Energy. And he and his wife, Jo, were married for 52 years until she passed away in February of 2020. Contributions in his memory can be made to the Immaculate Conception Church. I assume that's in Solon, they don't say. And if you were a fan of Starsky and Hutch or the 1977 hit Don't Give Up on Us, you may already know or would like to know that David Soule, who was a star of that Starsky and Hutch series, has passed away at age 30. His death was announced on the site formerly known as Twitter. No cause of death was given. In today's sports section of the Gazette, they seem to be focusing, as far as prep sports, on wrestling. So we have a girls' wrestling story from Riley Cole, Dateline Cedar Rapids. Mackenzie Childers remembers it like it was yesterday. Her mom was taking tickets at a Cedar Rapids Jefferson athletics event, and she saw wrestlers heading to the wrestling room for practice. On that fateful day in second grade, she knew she wanted to get out on the mat, too. Childers said, "I followed them into the wrestling room and watched. I knew wrestling was something I always wanted to do, so I started wrestling with Bad Boys Wrestling Club, and I was the only girl." On Thursday, she found herself back at that same school for a duel with Jefferson. This time, she was sporting Cedar Rapids Prairie's black and orange. "It's special to get to wrestle Jefferson in their own gym, since this is where I started wrestling. Some of my first tournaments were here," Childers said. Childers helped lead Prairie to a 57-12 win over Jefferson, with seven of the Hawks' match victories by fall. She was one of them, needing just 50 seconds to show her opponent, Chanceline Russi of Jefferson, the lights. Off to a dominating start in her junior campaign, with a record of 20-2 and ranked number one at 130 pounds, Childers is using her state title from a year ago as her motivation for working hard. She said, "This season, I've been working on the little things. After a state title, everyone is chasing you, and you have to work 10 times harder," end quote. One person who knows Childers is working hard is Prairie coach Zach, I hope I say this right, Becicka, B-E-C-I-C-K-A. He considers Childers as the team's catalyst and knows she has a drive for helping her teammates get back on the mat, saying, "It's like we have a fifth coach in the room. Whoever is wrestling with her as a partner is going to get some extra coaching on top of it. She understands the culture we are trying to build," end quote. With Prairie having no returning state qualifiers except for Childers, she is all about helping her teammates prepare for a strong showing during the postseason. One of her big goals, aside from repeating her state title, is having more Hawks at the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union State Tournament in February. She said, "I want to help them achieve their goal of being a state qualifier this year. I think it would be crazy to see some of our freshmen who are in their second or third year of wrestling make it to state." Basika said, "Childress sets the tone. It's been really exciting to see a lot of girls in our program who want to get to that level. We have some girls who are starting to take that role and want to be the best. It's just a matter of starting to believe that we can be the best," end quote. And under a more generic high school wrestling wrap-up, I guess, we have from KJ Pilcher, "Lynn Marr stockpiles bonus points in sweep of City High." KJ says, "Lynn Marr coach Doug Stryker had some concerns, more like questions. He wondered how the Lions would respond to their first duel in a few weeks, and after sitting through a long competition that left them in the bleachers for a few hours before taking the mat." Stryker said, "I told them things don't just happen, you have to make them happen. For the most part, I thought most of our guys made things happen for themselves, and it turned out good," end quote. Class 3A number 7 Lynn Marr won 8 matches, including 5 by pin, and defeated number 15 Iowa City High 49-25 in a Mississippi Valley Conference boys wrestling duel Thursday night at City High. The Lynn Marr girls wrestling team defeated City High 48-30 to open the sweep. The Lions earned bonus points in each victory, adding 2 major decisions and a technical fall. Stryker said, "I thought we wrestled pretty well," noting the Lions that did lose battled despite being outmatched. Stryker compared the return from break to the start of the season. "It is tough to get a good barometer of the team from practice. Nothing matches duels or tournaments to gauge progress, which made this duel important." Both teams combined for 12 ranked wrestlers, but they split the 2 ranked matchups. Kane Natboren of Lynn Marr took one of them, building a 14-5 lead before pinning number 9 Jake Mitchell in 3-11. He was unsure if he would have a match due to strategic moves and bumping weights and said, "I was pretty blessed to be able to wrestle. I always like wrestling good kids. I was just glad to wrestle." In the girls' duel, Lynn Marr recorded 6 first-period pins. Mallory Palmer, 105, and number 6 Kate Seary opened the contested matches with pins in 46 seconds and 1 minute, respectively. 7th-ranked 120-pounder Allie Jelinek, Reese Roberts at 125, and Brielle Park at 130 posted consecutive falls. Park managed 6 takedowns before a pin in 124. Kale Roberts added a pin at 140. And while there are no other stories in the Gazette about prep sports, my husband, Kelly Neff, has kindly put together some scores for me that he was able to find for girls and boys basketball and some additional wrestling scores. We'll start with the wrestling. Iowa City Liberty squeaked out a victory over Cedar Falls, 39-35. It was Iowa City West with a much more decisive victory over Cedar Rapids, Washington, 52-14. In girls basketball, here we go. Mount Vernon defeated Williamsburg, 52-39. It was East Buchanan decidedly over North Cedar, 75-26. Maquoketa certainly took on Lisbon, 60-32. Midland had a really strong victory over Starmont, 62-16. North Lynn and Calamus Wheatland landed with North Lynn at 74 and Calamus at 47. Springville beat Bellevue Marquette, 60-34. Oh, so a tough one. Solon beat Benton Community, 36-33. And Vinton Shelsburg and Independence ended at Vinton 47, Independence 37. In basketball for boys, it was Solon 72, Maquoketa 59, and Mount Vernon beat Clinton 50-41. And before we move to the Living Section Today article, we've got a few things to do today we can tell you about. Maybe one of these will interest you or someone you know. You can pass it along if somebody might be interested. First, from the music section, we have the Detour Band, which features Ron Johnson on percussion, Mark Lauterwasser on keyboards, bass guitar and vocals, Danny Roberts on lead guitar and vocals, and Rob Wallace on lead and harmony vocals. Detour Band serves up classic and top 40 country, as well as 1970s and 80s rock. Where are they going to be? They're going to be at the Riverside Casino and Golf Resort in Riverside. There is no cost for this, and it is from 7:30 to 11 tonight. You have another opportunity to hear music. This says from 8 to 11 a.m., but I have checked it out because that seems strange to me. 8 to 11 p.m. tonight at the CSPS Hall, 1103 3rd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. You can come join Vibe, six friends who love jamming together and connecting with audiences. Vibe includes Alicia Monique, Kelsey Madsen, Gerard Estella, Greg Kantz, E.J. Swive, and Lincoln Ginsburg. They asked for you to come and join them as they play classic songs reimagined. There is a cost from $15 to $18. If art is more to your liking, there is a museum exhibit at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art, 410 3rd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. You can get to for free to $10. There is an exhibit by Mauricio Lasansky, master printmaker, best known for large-scale prints in which he uses multiple plates and full ranges of color. He combines a spectrum of graphic techniques, including etching, dry point, aqua tint, and engraving, and you or someone you know might be able to appreciate that. And I'm going back to the Insight page for a minute. I had held this off because it looked like more of a thing to do today. There is only one community letter today in the Gazette, and it has to do with something that's occurring tomorrow, January 7th. So I'll just read the letter, and it is written by Mandy Remington, director of the Corridor Community Action Network in Iowa City. And it's under this title, Bring a Dish, the next C-CAN Winter Potluck is January 7th. And it's written, as the executive director of Corridor Community Action Network, which I think is called CCAN, I enjoy bringing people together to build community. Our winter potluck, co-hosted by LGBTQ Iowa Archives and Library, Repros for Iowa, Public Space One, Iowa City Area Group of the Sierra Club, and Iowa City Action for Palestine, promises an afternoon of warmth, laughter, and delicious bites. We'll be joined by Great Plains Action Society, Iowa City Green, Iowa AmeriCorps, and generous sponsor DeFliva Unit. Our community potlucks are more than meals. They're opportunities to forge connections, share stories, and build a sense of belonging. This is especially important, she says, when legislative attacks on inclusive education, our trans community, and our activists are leaving so many people feeling siloed. In the Robert A. Lee Social Hall, we will enjoy a diverse array of dishes and offer winter gear from C-CAN clothes crews, home energy audit signups with Green Iowa AmeriCorps, and other resources. Those who are able are encouraged to bring dishes or beverages to share, and we are still welcoming donors, co-hosts, sponsorships, entertainment/performances, and activities. She offers for people to reach out to her at director@corridorcan.com to let us know how you'd like to help. I know it's a little late for that, but perhaps you may want to reach out for a future date. Our seasonal potlucks celebrate diversity, foster understanding, and strengthen community bonds. Join us January 7th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Robert A. Lee Social Hall to embrace the season, savor delectable dishes, and create lasting memories. A public health recall notice is in the Gazette, so I will read it here. There's no direct reference to Iowa, but there are a lot of adjoining states that could be impacted, so I will go ahead and read this. It's reprinted from the Miami Herald. One lot of Buceto charcuterie samples that went to Sam's Club distribution centers in eight states has been recalled after one of the states found salmonella. The USDA's recall notice says Minnesota's Department of Agriculture turned up salmonella in a sample from Buceto Foods charcuterie sampler with prosciutto, sweet soppressata, and dry copa. And it is, they give the lot number, and it's a twin 9-ounce pack with a best buy date of April 27th, 2024. Distribution centers for Walmart's big box version receiving the meat product were in Minnesota, North Carolina, Texas, Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and Oklahoma. They talk about salmonella symptoms. They say that About 26,500 Americans wind up hospitalized annually by salmonella, and they say that anyone who bought the sampler can take it back to Sam's Club for a full refund or throw it in the garbage. So if by any chance you had friends or family traveling who might have brought this as a gift or something, just be cautious, be aware, and take the necessary action. A much more pleasant food-related article is from Elijah Decius of the Gazette in the Living section, and it's under the title Tex-Mex Adventure, with the subtitle UI Grad Completes Panchero's First Queso Cruise for a Free Year of Burritos. The article reads, on a recent Friday evening, one University of Iowa alum took a little detour on his way home for the holidays. Instead of taking a combination of interstates and state highways to get back to his family after leaving work at 5:30 p.m., Dubuque native Jared Ness went over the river and through the woods to all 26 Panchero's Mexican Grill locations in Iowa. But he said the payoff for completing the Iowa-based burrito brand's first Queso Cruise Challenge, a drive to all of its Iowa locations within a single day, was worth the effort. He received a year's supply of free burritos. Ness said, I've always been pretty adventurous. I just took a longer route home, end quote. Like many great ideas, it started when an obsession and a half-joke converged in a group chat. Ness's co-worker, Alex Gukin, came up with the idea during a conversation in the group chat. The friends spread across the state, but obsessed with Panchero's burritos and its signatures like fresh queso cheese sauce, started figuring out which location was closest to each of them. That's when Gukin, a marketing specialist with a passion for math, realized how easy it would be to go to multiple locations. With experience making sports spreadsheets to post to X, formerly known as Twitter, the Cyclone fan throws numbers together just for fun. And as a Panchero's fan since starting college at Iowa State University in 2012, he decided to apply his expertise to burritos. Gukin, who's age 29, said, I like spending time doing a lot of stupid math. It was a lunch break activity that turned into an all-day thing, end quote. Using an application to optimize the fastest route for 26 locations, he figured out that the journey could be done starting with the first morning opening and ended with the latest store closing in Iowa City with 5 minutes to spare in between each stop. The route drawn started up in West Des Moines at 10:30 a.m. and ended in Iowa City before its 1:45 a.m. closing, a route of 12 hours and 53 minutes. Then he tweeted it. He said of his initial impression, everybody thought the tweet was so stupid. I do it for my own entertainment, end quote. But after a few reposts and likes, it started to gain traction and the attention of Panchero's marketing team. They dared their social media followers to do it on December 13th, and they sweetened the deal with an offer for a free year of burritos to the first one to complete the challenge. Emma Reed, director of marketing for Panchero, said, we thought someone would do the challenge, but we weren't sure how long the process would take. We definitely have a strong fan base. We see that across our social media and our loyalty base. We always know they're up for a challenge, end quote. Then people started to take them up on the offer, prompting them to get a few rules in place. The rules were, participants had to be over 18 and residents of Iowa, a credit of 52 burritos valued at $650 would be awarded to the winner. Participants can enter in groups of up to 4 people, each eligible for their own 52 burritos, no purchase necessary. Entries must have a photo of every location, with each participant appearing in all photos. Each photo must be time-stamped, and the first and last time-stamps must be within 24 hours of each other. They also finally said that the participants must have an account on the Panchero's app. Now, how did he do it? Until the rules were posted, nobody was quite sure if Panchero's was serious, but just 30 minutes after seeing the fine print on December 15th, Ness packed his bags and took off after work to pull an all-nighter quest. He said, "I'm a young single bachelor. I have a little more free time on my hands." As Snapchat messages inundated his phone during the journey, he stayed awake during the 15-hour drive with one burrito for dinner, a couple energy drinks, and a call with a different friend scheduled every hour. That, as well as his enthusiasm for the food, carried him for 600 miles from Des Moines to Dubuque. He arrived home for the holidays in Dubuque at 8:30 the next morning. Ness also is a notorious fan of Culver's, which has sent him merchandise and gift cards for his loyalty, as well as the Blaze Pizza down the street from his place. He said, "I'm not a great cook, and I live by myself, so I eat out quite a bit." He has the flexibility to use his 52 burritos any way he wants this year, but still is on the fence about how to spend them, whether to ration them through his weekly budget or have a party and treat his coworkers. Besides Ness, two other groups of people completed the challenge, but didn't beat Jared to submitting their proof. One was self-described superfan Loudon Foster from Stewart, who eats at Pancheros 2 to 3 times a week. Foster was halfway through visiting all locations when the official rules came out stipulating that participants needed to appear in a photo of every location. He said, "I like to say I'm Pancheros' biggest fan. It gets crazy how often I eat there." Trying to cover his bases without knowing the rules, the Simpson College student even bought a burrito at each location to fill his freezer. His adrenaline was all he needed to stay awake for the drive. It took him slightly over 15 hours to visit every location, but despite no win, he said he'd do it again, saying, "I had a good experience. I liked the challenge of it." With so many locations, there was a lot of planning into it and the route you had to go to visit in a certain order. Pancheros marketing director Reed said the chain hasn't made plans for another cruise just yet, but will monitor its fans' engagement for future challenges.